through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
Well, here we are. Fun's over, guys. I don't know what to tell you. All those heart-stopping, last-second wins, interceptions in the end zone of Dak Prescott pass attempts, and touchdowns on 4th and 6 to beat the Vikings. That was the fun part. That was it. That was the easy time of the season, and you made it through. And guess what, you guys? Now it's the tough stretch. What you just experienced, that was fun. That's what that was. Your heart stopping with seconds remaining in a game, not knowing what'll happen. Yeah, that was a great time. That was the best time. Seahawks are 5-0 coming out of that stretch. And now they enter what could be the toughest stretch of the season. In fact, what the three of us will argue is the toughest stretch of the season, specifically these next 5 weeks here. Before I throw to you, Jake, and my co-host Tom, I'm going to read to you guys the next 5 games on the Seahawks schedule. October 25th at Cardinals. That's the one coming up this Sunday, obviously. They're coming off a nice win over the Dallas Cowboys. Then you got November 1st versus the 49ers. November 8th at the Bills. November 15th at the Rams. Shout out to Jared Goff, Tom. November 19th, Thursday Night Football versus the Cardinals. 5 weeks will tell us 3 big things about this team. Jake, I'm going to start with you. What's one thing it's going to tell us?
Okay, well, one thing that it's clearly going to tell us is we've been talking about let Russ cook all offseason. How is that going to go? How is that going to progress? What will that look like as they face the toughest part of their schedule here over the next 5 weeks as they face division opponents? Are they going to continue to do so? Are they going to lean more into their running game, try to be more physical in their approach offensively? They're going to continue to need to put the ball in Russell Wilson's hands and in this offense hands. And by doing so, this is going to be the greatest challenge for Russell Wilson's MVP campaign. His MVP campaign will be made right here in these next 5 weeks. As he goes up against the Rams, who are giving up a total of 209.5 passing yards per game, 4th fewest in the league, 20 sacks, with Aaron Donald having 7.5 of them, 5th most in the league. You're going against the 49ers, 212 passing yards per game, 5th fewest in the NFL. Then you have the Arizona Cardinals, who are giving up the 11th fewest, 17 sacks, which ranks 7th most. And then the Buffalo Bills, who traditionally has been a good defense over the last couple of years, I still think are a good defense. They've kind of been the outlier, giving up, they rank 24th in passing yards per game. But this is going to be a really tough stretch here for Russell Wilson, and this is where he's going to be able to flex his muscle and show that, hey, he is the undisputed MVP. If they go through a series of 4-1, if they were to go undefeated, you could pretty much wrap it up at that point because they will have separated themselves clearly in a lot of other areas. But Russell Wilson, his MVP campaign will absolutely be made here in 5 weeks. And here in cut number one, Russell Wilson talking about he doesn't want just one vote. He wants to win it.
I don't want a vote. You know, I think more importantly, I want to win, and I think, obviously MVP is a special award. This is the best football players in the world. There's so many great guys. I think about guys like Lamar last year. It was unbelievable last year. Such a great player. Guys like Patrick Mahomes and some other greats, obviously, that still play this game, and Tom and Drew. And, I think for me, I want to be regarded as one of the best to ever play this game, to be honest with you. I think it's part of the process, and hopefully, I can, win enough games and do enough special things as a team to be able to do that. It's a team award, really, I think, in terms of the MVP.
AKA, yeah, I might not be talking about it, but I want to win. And winning in this 5 week stretch translates to me winning the MVP. So, Stacy, these 5 weeks, okay. I think that's one of the things that will be determined.
All right, Tom, Jake says things determined in the next 5 weeks are Russell Wilson's MVP campaign. What do you say?
Boy, if he doesn't win it now, he's never going to win it. Yeah, we're going to find out whether or not the Seahawks are truly. God, I hate using this word, elite in the NFC, or if they're just another strong contender like 4 or 5 other teams. By the way, either scenario would be okay. I mean, at worst, to be just another strong contender, that's still fine. But these other teams are looking up at the Seahawks. So they're going to be figuring out the same thing about themselves. The difference is that being undefeated, Seattle's more likely to come down and the others would come up. The question from yesterday as to whether or not a loss would benefit Seattle will be answered later on. We can only really figure that out in retrospect. So nothing here is etched in stone, but the picture will come more into focus, nevertheless, over the next 5 weeks. And I think either scenario, I mean, look, if they go 0-5, that's one thing. It's like, whoa, we had some major weaknesses and we just didn't know it, or they were worse than we thought. I don't think that's going to happen. I think they'll be okay in the standings either way. But what will we learn from a win? What will we learn from a loss, or five wins or five losses or whatever the scenario is? That's what's important.
This hour of Tom, Jake, and Stacey is brought to you by the Pro Club. Tom Wassel, Jake Heap, Stacey Ross here, talking about what the next 5 weeks will tell us about the Seahawks. Jake Heap says it's Russell Wilson's MVP campaign. That's what we're going to learn here. Tom says we're going to find out whether or not the Seahawks are truly elite in the NFC. 710-710 on the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line. Join in that conversation. What are the next 5 weeks going to tell us about the Seahawks? Here, Jake and Tom, is what I think we will learn. You're going to find out whether or not this defense will keep you from a Super Bowl. We know that this offense can win a Super Bowl. We know Russell Wilson, who's on pace to throw over 60 touchdowns this season, Lord knows whether or not he's going to do it. If he does, that would shatter the NFL record held by Peyton Manning, I believe was 55-ish, set back in 2013. Russell Wilson playing like the MVP, looking like the MVP, offense full of stars, offensive line fantastic. The defense, on the other hand, despite having two All-Pros, despite having a couple Pro Bowlers and guys you want being the cornerstones of your team moving forward, defense giving up 471.2 total yards per game, most in the NFL, and 370.4 passing yards per game. Here's why I see it that way, you guys. This is the toughest part of your schedule, and the competition in the postseason will only get tougher. If you can't keep Kyler Murray and Jared Goff at bay, what are you going to do against Aaron Rodgers? What are you going to do against Tom Brady? If the Saints get in there, what are you going to do against Drew Brees? It only gets harder from here.
And that's, I think, is a really good point there that both of you guys make. And Stacey, when you talk about this defense in particular, they have to change, right? Something has to give here. And you're hoping that this group can turn it around, that they can get better, that getting some of these guys back, adding Snacks Harrison is going to help your run defense, is going to playing with more continuity in the back end is going to help you, over the rest of the season and through the playoffs. So that is one thing that I think has to be addressed here defensively. If they're going to truly be a Super Bowl contender, if we're going to find out whether this team is legit or not, as Tom mentioned earlier, it's going to come down to how they are able to play versus these physical offensive teams in the Rams, in the 49ers, and yes, the Arizona Cardinals. They're running the ball at a very high level right now, per yards per game, Arizona is. So they're going to have to step up in a variety of different ways. There's no question.
Now, I haven't seen this come in before. I really like this one. The next 5 weeks will tell us, .. Again, 710-710, text your answer in. From the 360, Tom, tell me what you think about this. If Chris Carson will deserve an extension.
Ooh.
I like that.
Let's see, do we
he
know
can't be
that
one-dimensional
now?
Offense.
Right, yeah, we definitely don't. Well, actually, you know what's interesting about that is there anything about Chris Carson that we think we don't know right now? I mean, if he goes out and he has this burst of just unbelievable statistical performance over the next 5 weeks or even beyond, are the Seahawks going to look at that and say, that's the real Chris Carson, that's what we're always going to get, that's what we're paying for? Or do they know what he is already and sort of have their minds made up about that, and it's just a question of finances? I don't know.
I think it has to do more with the idea that you look at the way that they utilize him, right? They already know what Chris Carson is. They already know what he can do and what he can bring to the table for this group and the talent that overall he is. I think that this organization holds Chris Carson in high regard. But if you go through these next five games and you're continuing to win games relying on Russell Wilson passing the football and having these high offensive outputs, maybe it makes you think that, hey, we don't need to invest big money in a running back moving forward because we're not utilizing it in the same way. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I could see where that conversation goes, or vice versa. They start using him more. You start to see him get those, you know, 20, 25 carries per game over the next 5 weeks. It just shows you how valuable and how important he is to this offense as a whole being successful.
Now, the 509 come in with the heat right now, the hot take, not holding any jabs back. Are you ready for this? And 509, I got to say, I might agree with you on this. I don't want to, but I might. A team with the number 32 defense does not belong in a conversation as it relates to elite. Never has, never will. I mean,
no. How can you say, okay, based on what?
I think based on the fact that you, how can you be the best team in the NFL when you have the worst defense in the NFL? In terms of passing yards, I would like to say to the 509, Seattle ranks 32nd in passing yards allowed, total yards allowed, not rushing yards. I think they've fallen since that, though, since the game against Minnesota. They do not rank in the bottom of the league in points allowed, which is a very, very notable stat here. But still, the defense needs to step up.
I know, but to say that is to isolate one particular stat and base everything around that. I mean, if a team, and we may see it. I mean, if the Seahawks go 3-2 over this next stretch and they're 8-2, still in first place, still with the best record in the conference, and let's say they give up even more passing yards or more yards total, we'll just, you know, give the texture the benefit of the doubt. I mean, and they're winning games. Isn't that what's most important?
You would think. You would think. I mean, it is worth noting there was a really interesting article by Bob Condotta in the Seattle Times saying that, you know, hey, Seattle's on pace to shatter some records defensively held by some of the worst defenses to advance to a Super Bowl or to win a Super Bowl. Your New York Giants back in, I think, 2011, one of those teams, Tom, even they were allowing, I think, almost 100 fewer yards than Seattle is. So we'll see if we can ask Bob about that later this week. But I mean, it is interesting. It is a something of note. Offenses are throwing more this year. They're getting more yards. They're getting more points. But man, that defense is a problem right now.
They are. But it you have to pose the question. You have to pose the question and have to think about that and mention those, because it's never been done before. It's never in the history of this game given up this much offensive output. A defense has rendered this many yards and this much production and won a Super Bowl. It just hasn't been done. So yeah, it's going to be a question mark all the way through if they don't change. And I think it's going to be a concern. Is it going to cost you games? Is it going to cost you a Super Bowl opportunity? That's always going to be in the back of everybody's mind unless things change defensively. So I don't think it's one of those things that we can just, right away that, they can figure it out and they can win despite that. Maybe they can, but that would be something the NFL has yet to have seen. Doesn't mean it's not possible, but it certainly makes it for a bumpy ride.
All right, what are we going to learn over the next 5 weeks about this Seahawks team? 710-710, send your answer in there. We're going to ask Mike Salk about that coming up at 12:30. But first, let's get to three questions.
It's time for three questions.
Can't wait for it.
Every day at 12 after 12, Tom Wassel's burning questions for Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
Enough with the "we got to protect the kids" nonsense. Which team scares you the most right now in a head-to-head matchup? I'm not asking who's going to win the division. Arizona, San Francisco, or the Rams of Los Angeles, Stacey?
I don't want to have this answer, Tom, because it's only going to make you feel vindicated. But I'm going to say the number one is the Rams. They're the most balanced team to me. They have the potential to be explosive on offense. Aaron Donald, one of the best players in the NFL, in NFL history, I'd say, healthy on that team. Number two would be the Arizona Cardinals, especially after last night's performance against the Cowboys. That defense looked solid. Kyler Murray's impossible to bring down. And then I'd say San Francisco at three, only because of injuries.
I would agree with Stacey on number one. Number one to me is the Rams. And the reason why is because of the two other teams that is listed, the Rams are the only ones to me that have, just for whatever reason, under Sean McVay, under Jeff Fisher, they've always been the Seahawks' kryptonite for whatever reason. And so I think that whenever you go up against them, then you factor in Sean McVay. You factor in that offense that has really gotten the best of Pete Carroll. And I know that's going to drive him nuts to have that said, but it's the truth. And it's got to change. Something's got to give there. So I think they have the hardest time with the Los Angeles Rams as in general. That's why I picked them number one. But then number two to me is San Francisco. I just think that they are going to continue to get healthier. When you see them come up with a big win like that versus the Rams, they're going to gain even more confidence. So the San Francisco 49ers concern me second most. In Arizona, I just still think that they are a young team that is still trying to find their way. I believe that Kyler Murray is outstanding. They have tremendous offensive weapons. Defensively, Buda Baker she is one of my favorite players to watch in the NFL right now. But they are not, they haven't played enough games together and have overcome enough adversity for me to think that they can go toe-to-toe with the Seahawks on a consistent basis.
Go Dawgs.
That's the point, is that they're young together. I mean, they've got players who are, I mean, they've got Kenyon Drake, they've got Hopkins, and Murray at this point, I feel like, as a veteran.
Correct.
Just because of what he's been asked to do, and Buda Baker and everybody. I mean, they've got experience, certainly, on the team, but you're right, winning together, they haven't been through those battles yet. My answer, my cop-out answer is all of them. And here's the thing about here's the thing about the passing yards from before, okay? They could conceivably play better defensively against all of these teams and still lose all of the games. That's why it's not wise to isolate things like yardage given up and to define a team strictly according to that, because you could win or lose even if you played better in terms of giving up total yardage. So that's why I don't just isolate that. Next.
Number two.
We talked a lot about leadership yesterday. Quarterback leadership, Brady and Rodgers and Russell Wilson, et cetera, different styles. It got me thinking, who's more responsible for leadership? And I'll throw Mike McCarthy into this because he's now without his quarterback. Who's more responsible for leadership, a head coach or a quarterback, Jake?
Well, overall, in terms of the structure of a team, it's your head coach. But when it comes to performance on the field, I believe that your quarterback has a large determining factor as to how you perform and how you're able to overcome adversity. So I think as a whole, you look at Mike McCarthy, that was the example that you give. Mike McCarthy, you have to really question his leadership at this point. Offensively, they look lost. Defensively, they look even more lost. They look like they're lost in a 20-foot blizzard right now and don't know how to shovel their way out. It just doesn't seem like there's anybody providing any answers or any clear direction. And Mike McCarthy, the worst quote I have ever seen. You just got the absolute doors knocked off. You just got blown out and embarrassed on Monday Night Football. And post-game, he says, quote, I thought we had our best practice yet this week. How can you say that? How can you legitimately look at the press and everybody, and Cowboys fans, and the NFL media, and say that? I just don't understand that. There's no direction there. There's no clear leadership going on and trying to really, truly get things headed in the right direction.
I got to go head coach. I look at Dallas as a good example of this. Dak Prescott's clearly a leader, but there's only so much that a quarterback can do, especially either if the talent around him, looking at the defensive side of the ball, isn't great or consistent. I think that a head coach does a lot for a team, almost more than, surprisingly, they're given credit for. I got to go head coach on this one.
I'll go head coach on it, too. And look, there's a lot of different ways you can lead, as we discussed yesterday. You don't have to be the rah-rah inspirational guy. You can be stoic. You can lead with experience, just sort of that built-in experience. There's something about Mike McCarthy that seems to be just on the surface, not been in a locker room with him, but on the surface, like, lacking. He seems a little bit too administrative in a way. And I just don't know. Like, what is it about Mike McCarthy that makes players want to run through a wall? I don't think that quality is there. I think that he's a great coordinator, a great offensive play caller, but Aaron Rodgers really helped that man and Brett Favre before him. Next.
Number three.
Michael Bumpus, our colleague, had an interesting comment on who the most talented player in the NFL is. Go ahead and roll cut number two.
Kyler Murray is the most talented quarterback in the NFL. Not the best quarterback. He can throw with Pat. He can run with Lamar. He is the most talented. He's not the best quarterback. When you think of the best quarterbacks in the game, Patrick Mahomes is up there. Russell Wilson is up there. Lamar Jackson won the MVP last year. Now, talent means he can run fast. He can throw it far. He's elusive. It doesn't mean that, okay, fourth quarter, I'm going to give it to Kyler Murray to win the football game. No, that's Russell Wilson's job. It's not he's going to lead this team to a Super Bowl. No, that's Pat Mahomes' job. You just look at the physical attributes. He was 9-for-24 last night, but I still saw him make some throws. I'm like, that ball traveled 55, 60 yards in the air, and he barely missed.
I think that's really well articulated by Bump. I mean, he covers every aspect that he needs to right there and makes a tremendous case for him. Jake?
Under those specific guidelines, when you just talk about talent at this stage of his career, yeah, I would agree with Michael Bumpus that he probably is the most talented quarterback when you talk about putting it all together from arm, quick release, to his running ability, his escapability, all of those factors. I think that Kyler is that. But the problem with that is you can't gloss over 9-for-24, okay? Like, 9-for-24, although a blowout win, what that tells me is that you have serious issues defensively with the Dallas Cowboys than you do have Kyler Murray playing out of his mind right now. The Arizona Cardinals are playing very inconsistent, and Kyler Murray is a big part of that equation. So he is the most – I would agree with Bumpus that he's probably the most talented quarterback right now, but definitely not the most consistent. As of right now, not the most reliable.
I got to say Patrick Mahomes was further along at the same stage of his career, although Kyler Murray is a phenomenal talent. Kyler Murray is, I think, underrated in general. He's a guy that's incredibly elusive, impossible to bring down. The Seahawks defense is going to have a really tough time against him this Sunday. I don't know that I would say most talented. It's hard to say that fairly in a league with some of the best athletes in the world. If I'm making a list, and this isn't necessarily same stage of the career because Kyler Murray would be higher, but right now if I'm making a list of just like most talented, ahead of Murray I've got Russell Wilson, Patrick Mahomes, Aaron Donald, Derrick Henry as guys that just at any moment look like the most talented guys on a field.
Yeah, and that's a great point. I really do like that. I think that I think you have to put the distinction as well with this, and it maybe wouldn't change your answer, Stacey, and I wouldn't disagree with you, that with Kyler and what Bump's saying is your talent is different than your production.
Yeah.
Because when you put 9-for-24, I mean, that automatically, you combine the two, that automatically puts you down the list pretty significantly, in my opinion. But when you just talk about talent at the position, I mean, he's got everything that you would want outside of just height.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. You know what, though? Me and Tom are team petites. We're going to get an all-star petite draft. Kyler Murray's going to be part of it. I'm going to go ahead and take Clyde Edwards-Helaire also. It's going to be great. Okay. All right.
Solid squad.
Darren Sproles.
Yeah.
Can I still pick him?
Well, no, only active players, but he can be part of our all-time. Petite all-time. Okay. All right, Mike Salk joins us next. We'll ask him what these next 5 weeks will tell us about the Seahawks. This is Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacey Rost.
What are we going to learn about the Seahawks in the next 5 weeks of the season? Mike Salk joining us right now, brought to you by Jafco Plumbing and Sewer. Mike, so that you know, I know you already know the next opponent, the Arizona Cardinals, but we've also got in order the 49ers, the Bills, at Rams, and then a Thursday night football game versus the Cardinals here at CenturyLink. What are we going to learn about the Seahawks?
I think we're going to find out how they can handle creative offenses. right? We've seen them throughout the year, and their defense obviously has struggled through its first five games despite the wins. But I think the common theme from those opponents is a level of creativity, whether it's the offensive coordinator, certainly in both L.A. and in San Francisco, or whether it's the quarterback himself in both Buffalo and in Arizona, you're going to see a level of offensive creativity that we haven't really had much of a chance to see so far. And they've struggled against teams without a ton of offensive creativity. So how are they going to handle quarterbacks who are elusive, right? Kyler Murray, if you got a chance to watch last night, I mean, good luck. That dude is so naturally quick, and he moves in such a unique way. Just the escapability is off the charts. And then a kind of a different style of escapability with Josh Allen, who's bigger, tougher. I mean, he's physical, but equally challenging to bring down. And so how do they handle quarterbacks with that kind of creativity, which we haven't really seen yet? Cam is fast and big, but I don't know if he's got the same level of creativity that Kyler Murray has. So
stylistically.
Yeah, just different, right? Kyler Murray, just the ability to move around and dance. I mean, Cam will plow you over and then outrun you. Kyler is he's so interesting in the way he just runs around and moves. It's very similar to Russell. And then with San Francisco and L.A., you just get offensive coordinators who are constantly picking at your weaknesses. So I'm very, very curious to see, and I think we'll learn quite a bit about this Seahawks defense during that time.
Now, here's my question, and I think this is a tough one here, and I think that you've tried to go through this and figure this out yourself many different times, but you talk about the defense, and you talk over the next 5 weeks. Whose responsibility does it fall heaviest on? Is it Pete Carroll or Ken Norton Jr.? Because I think that's where people are looking at it and wondering, okay, who ultimately takes the responsibility for this defense and whether or not it gets turned around?
Yeah, the buck stops with Pete. I mean, especially as a defensive coach, I think the buck stops with him. But that means that it's part of Pete's job to be analyzing Ken Norton Jr.'s job and see how he's doing. And if he's doing a good enough job and the problem is with the players or something that they think they can fix, then fine. Then the buck stops with Pete. If he's looking at it and saying that Norton's not getting the job done, then it's up to him to try to fix that mid-season. And that's why I'm a fan of bringing in and talking to Dan Quinn. I don't know whether it's a consultant basis or what, but this is a guy who understands your defense, was your defensive coordinator when you won the Super Bowl, and he's out there and available right now. I think that you want every fresh pair of eyes that you possibly can to take a look at this and try to figure out what's wrong so that you're not giving up as many points, yards, and big plays as you are.
Watching Kyler Murray kind of made me think about this. I've heard you say before that you think that in the NBA they should think about widening the court because players' physical abilities have sort of outgrown the limitations of the NBA game. Do you think that we will ever reach a point where quarterbacks' abilities might outgrow the current NFL game as they become just more physically talented?
That's a good question. I haven't thought of it that way, right? I mean, the NFL field still seems large enough to me now, and I don't know that Kyler Murray is going to be enough to make me change my mind on that. However, if the trends continue, if the evolution continues the way it has over the last few years and offense continues to grow the way it does, could the NFL field feel small? Yeah, maybe, but here's the problem. If you were to make it, let's say, wider, Tom, let's say you went 10 yards, 5 yards on either side of the field, who do you think would benefit from that? The offense. I mean, it would be just another way, and this kind of relates back to the conversation we had yesterday.
It would become the CFL.
It would just be another way of making the passing game even more effective because it's more space that the defense would have to cover. I think that becomes even more challenging.
Hear me out, though.
Right, but I mean, one thing you could do, just very quickly. I mean, you wouldn't have to widen it. You could lengthen it the other way, make the the field like 150 yards.
You could.
Instead of 10 yards for a first down, maybe you say it's 15 or 20.
Well, that
or
to me is
like
that to me is a much more. I think the last suggestion makes the most sense, and I hadn't thought of it. The problem with making the field longer is really the only time that the defenses get a break is when they get close to the end zone, and the red zone provides an extra defender for them because it takes away the threat of the deep ball, right? So that being said, so I don't know that making the field longer does that, but I'm fascinated by the idea of a first and 15 or a first and 12 or changing some of that. I mean, there may come a point where if this is all about the passing offense, you have to make the first down distance longer. But here's again the problem. Now you're taking the run away even more, because at least with a 10-yard first down, it still makes sense at times to run. Who's running if it's first and 15? Now you're essentially
Seattle.
Committing to a exactly. You're now committing to even more importance to the pass. So while it makes sense at first, I think there'd be unintended consequences.
It's not that. Like other things aren't also balancing that out, though. Like, one, offensive line play coming out of college in general is declining, and B, defensive end, and I'd say in some systems outside linebackers are like otherworldly now also. I mean, think of like Chase Young would take over the league 20 years ago,
right? And now good luck. Yeah, I mean, there's a simpler way to do this, which is allow the defensive backs to clutch and grab a little bit, stop making such an emphasis on illegal contact. Like, just let them put their hands on a receiver. Make a call pass interference evenly.
Is there any way to go back from that, though?
Sure.
Like, where they are right now, how can you take a step back? Well, I say that knowing that they made offensive holding an emphasis last year and then completely
just
walked
just
it back
stop
this
calling
year.
Everything on the defense and occasionally call offensive pass interference. There was a play I was watching, I forget it was over the weekend or yesterday, where the wide receiver shoved the dude 5 yards out of the way, turned around, and then they're like, oh, great play, great route. Like, is it, or did he completely shove the defensive back away from? Well, how often do they call offensive pass interference in the NFL?
Rarely.
Almost never. And yet, if you watch the game, I would suggest that there is very close to being as much OPI as there is defensive.
I could talk about this for a really long time, but I'm not going to. But I want to keep going, because then I want to explore all my own conspiracy theories about jersey sales and...
Yeah, my head's about to explode listening to this. It's
as a quarterback, you're like,
mind.
More DPI.
Well, there's
honestly,
no
more
OPI
defensive
ever.
Holding.
It's all
DPI.
Yeah. Whatever.
Let's just
stop
widen
giving
the field.
Them bailing
let's
them out.
Salk wants to take this back to where you could crush people over the middle of the field. You could spear
yes,
people and there'd be no penalty.
Bring back Jack Tatum.
I know you do.
Yes.
That's exactly
give me Jack Tatum.
When you talk about wanting to bring back some of that physicality, I think that you're going to love the next 5 weeks, Salk,
yeah.
Because you look at the next 5 weeks and you get into this NFC West battle, you're going to need the running game. You're going to need it to be able to limit Aaron Donald, to be able to limit and control the game, take the ball away from a playmaker like Kyler Murray. So I think you're going to see that element really come through, and it's going to be interesting to see the difference in the 5 weeks. The first 5 weeks to the second 5 weeks of how much they put the ball in Russell Wilson's hands and how much they try to establish that line of scrimmage, where do you feel they will go?
I think they'll be a little bit more balanced than they've been, but I don't think there's any chance they all of a sudden come out and say, oh, we got to reestablish the run and that's who we are. Like, I mean, they've made it pretty clear now through 5 weeks that they are going to throw the ball a whole lot more than they run it, and that's fine. I don't necessarily have a problem with that. But I do think they're going to need to show some creativity in their run game, and it's going to need to be successful for them. I wouldn't mind seeing Russell keep it now and again, right? The little read option play where he keeps it and run around the end. I think that opens things up over the next few weeks for them to do what they've got to do. But look, as much as this is a tough stretch, the nice thing is in the last 2 weeks, each of these teams they're going to play have all shown their vulnerability. We've seen Buffalo get beat a couple of times now. We saw San Francisco look like complete garbage 2 weeks ago. Then we saw them beat the Rams. We've seen Arizona lose to a not very good team as well. So you know, all four of these teams in five games have shown their vulnerability. It's up to you to now go through this. And if you can come through at 3-2, I'd say you've been successful. If you can come through it at 4-1, my gosh, I mean, you're doing handsprings because you're so happy.
Handsprings. You can hear Mike on the weekly Brock and Salk podcast. New episodes drop Tuesday nights. That's tonight.
But not tonight.
Not
we're
tonight.
Off.
Why?
We're
What's
off
wrong
this
with
week.
You? Well, oh, you have a vacation.
We
you
have
couldn't
a vacation
stop
week.
To do one episode on spearing
what?
And
we
establishing
have a during the season.
What are you even
during
doing
during the bye week?
Vacationing where?
During the bye week. Huh?
It's not the bye week
Green
anymore.
Lake. Brock and I have a beautiful spot of Green Lake for our vacation.
Together?
Yes, we have a picnic.
Oh, that's lovely. I love that. Okay, yeah. Well, never mind. No Brock and Salk podcast.
Next week.
But you can still hear Brock on Danny and Gallant every
yes.
weekday morning. Also, Mike Salk right here, 12:30 every single weekday. So don't worry, you guys. They're still here. Happy vacation on a non-bye week, Mike.
It's a bye week. This is the bye week week. The is week it? Of the bye
I'm kicking you off week. Now. Okay. The NFL trade deadline is November 3rd. Should the Seahawks make a move? We'll talk about that next on Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Rost.
The NFL trade deadline is November 3rd, so should the Hawks make a trade? Now, here's one thing we got to know. There's so many teams right now that are clearly out of the hunt. You got the Jets that might not even win a game this season. You got the New York Giants, no offense, Tom, that might finish with maybe one or two wins. You've got some other teams. Right. You've got some other teams that are just clearly not in it. It's only 5 weeks in, but they just look abysmal. So should John Schneider and Pete Carroll pick off anyone from these teams that might already be looking to reset for next year? Jake, you mentioned a couple targets during our show prep. You want to share a few of these potential trade targets for the Seattle Seahawks?
Yeah, look, you could have somebody like Quandre Diggs who doesn't cost you a lot in terms of trade capital. He was they only had to give up a fifth round pick, but a lot of these names are going to be big names that you wonder, really, Jake, are these guys that the Seahawks could really trade for, that they would have enough draft capital to be able to acquire these players? But also, you have to remember that these teams potentially are in situations that are basically in reset mode. They know they're not getting to the playoffs. They know that they're having to look towards the following year. They're going to have to make roster decisions. So they are willing to part with lesser draft capital with the opportunity to at least receive some compensation rather than none as they let them go into free agency. So offensively, a couple targets that I have is receiver Julio Jones from the Atlanta Falcons. They are in major cap trouble. Kenny Golladay, you look at him from the Detroit Lions, Cincinnati's A.J. Green, Cleveland's Odell Beckham Jr., the Philadelphia Eagles' Zach Ertz. Defensively, you've got Atlanta's Grady Jarrett, Washington Redskins' Ryan Kerrigan, Tom's favorite person in the world, Houston Texans' J.J. Watt.
Huge fan.
Then, from Cincinnati, Carlos Dunlap or Geno Atkins. Cleveland, Olivier Vernon. These are all names that I believe are legitimately going to be in trade conversations, and the Seahawks have the opportunity, if they want to make one more splash move to really go after the Super Bowl with the trade deadline coming up on November 3rd, I think these are all names that the Seahawks could potentially be looking at. And you may wonder about the offensive side of the ball, but if your defense is not going to get any better, then you certainly want to continue to keep adding weapons.
Tom, if I'm telling you possible names are Julio Jones, Kenny Golladay, A.J. Green, Odell Beckham Jr., Zach Ertz, Grady Jarrett, J.J. Watt, Carlos Dunlap, is any name standing out to you as someone you'd want? They're obviously all good players,
Right. I love the idea of Grady Jarrett or Geno Atkins. The problem is the draft picks. I want to say before we even get to that, though, I'm not really sure why on some of these lists, like if you Google trade scenarios, possible NFL trade pieces, why Cleveland has so many names on those lists, like David Njoku or who? Like, why is Cleveland all of a sudden the seller? They're a contender. Why would they do that? I don't quite understand that. Oh, like Beckham.
Well, part of it is because they have depth. Part of it is because they have depth at those positions. Tight end, they're actually in a really good spot with depth there. And Joku's barely really playing. Odell Beckham Jr., I think that you look at him, and there's obviously been some frustrations on his side and also organizationally with him as well. So I think when you look at these moves, and Olivier Vernon, he can certainly help your ball club with his pass rushing ability. But you also have a first-year head coach, and you're trying to continue to build your roster moving into the following year. So if you could pick up another draft pick or two or another solid player in return, I think that that's why the Cleveland Browns could potentially be sellers in this situation.
I guess
I was going to say any of these guys though that are worth trading for that could make a difference. Like I love Vernon. Vernon can make a difference, but A, where are you going to play him? B, what are you going to have to give up to get him? I mean, we're already short on draft picks of the higher-end variety. So am I willing? I mean, there's that phrase, mortgaging the future. To some extent, the Seahawks have already done that. Are we willing to go even further down that path just to go. Then we start talking about Super Bowl or bust, because we had that conversation on Friday. You start giving up more draft picks, important higher-end draft picks, for guys like, you know, Vernon or, I mean, especially the wide receivers or the pass catchers. Like, I'd love to have Zach Ertz, and maybe you could find a scenario where you move a Hollister with a draft pick for him. Like, that type of thing I could see. But bringing in Julio Jones or A.J. Green, I mean, how those are great players, no doubt. But how much better can you really get by bringing in a guy like that when your offense is already just supremely talented and productive?
Well, it's the question of adding one more to take you over the top. It's not just it's like
from the quarterback.
It's splurging. It's splurging, Tom. If you're Jalen Ramsey, if you're the Los Angeles Rams, and you're trying to look for a matchup problem, who are you going to cover? Right? You're going to cover DK Metcalf? All right. Well, then you got Julio Jones on the other side and Tyler Lockett in the middle. It puts defenses that much more in a bind in terms of how they game plan, how easy it is for them to try and, you know, figure out where their winning matchups are. So that's why offensively they don't knock the potential of the Seahawks potentially adding to the offensive side of the ball here. I think that's still very much on the table. If they cannot find the right add defensively at the right price, I think J.J. Watt, Ryan Kerrigan, Carlos Dunlap, you know, these are all players that I think could potentially fall on the roster here in Seattle if things were to work out from a trade standpoint where they weren't having to give up so much capital. And these are all players that are in their, you know, lower 30s that are, I don't want to say at the end of their career because their production is still high, but they don't have, you know, 5-6 years left in the league where they can really, really command as high of capital as they want, as they could have maybe, you know, 3 years ago for each of these players.
But even if it's not a first round pick, I mean, the first part of Tom's question is my question also, which is like, how much more would John Schneider be willing to part with? You already gave away 2 first-round picks for Jamal Adams. Even if Julio Jones or Zach Ertz aren't commanding a first-round pick, you think that John Schneider is going to want to go in 2021 without a first or second or maybe a third? I mean, what are you giving up?
Right. It just depends on what you're looking at it moving towards the future, right? It would be difficult to walk into any draft and not have a first and second round pick. There's no question about that. But the reality is that here in 2020, if you feel like you're at this point where you can really, you know, take yourself over the top by adding another player here, another weapon, then I think that this club is willing to do that. The second part is you talk about, do they need to give up a second round pick? I don't necessarily think so. I think that they could provide a player that is someone of need to a particular team at a position of need, as well as maybe a fourth round pick instead of a second round pick. So I think that John Schneider and this group is unbelievable at working the deals and making sure they're exhausting every single possibility at their disposal. And I think that there are a lot of sellers, more maybe than ever in the last few years. And I think that the Seahawks are probably going to look at this and see if they can take advantage of it.
All right, we'll get back to this in the halftime show at 1:30. But first, Pete Carroll spoke with reporters for the first time since entering the bye week. Hear what your head coach had to say next on Tom, Jake, and Stacey.